Hey y'all, thanks for joining us on the forum again this week to socialize with science. I'm Daniela.
And I'm Cleo.
And I am Aubrey.
So now that we're all here, you want to fill us in on what we're chatting about today?
Sure. So today's episode is based on one of my favorite policy position papers of all ISGP time, mostly because I remember interviewing Dr. Sanson before the actual conference. I swear I was keeping him on the line way beyond his time with all of my questions.
Okay, but let's calm down and back it up a second. Who's Dr. Sampson?
Okay, right. So Dr. Colin Sampson is a professor at the Department of Sociology at the University of Essex, which is actually very close to where I live right now. His policy position paper was titled Reversing the Nutrition Transition Among Native North Americans.
And it was debated at an ISGP conference titled Equitable, Sustainable, and Healthy Food Environments, which took place at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver about 2 years ago in the spring of 2016.
Now, you may have noticed, if you're a forum regular, that our last two episodes were actually derived from this very conference, which is cool because it's allowed us to get into a few niches surrounding nutrition. Last week, we talked about robotic cow milkers and other crazy ag tech. And the week before that, we discussed the double burden of obesity and undernutrition. Today, we'll continue on the path of nutritional changes and deficiencies, case studying indigenous populations to find out why they've been so badly impacted by food system changes.
But before we get started, just a friendly reminder that we very much welcome, in fact, very much encourage, any comments or questions on this episode via our social media channels.
You can reach us via Twitter with our handle at ISGPForum or on Facebook at www.facebook.com/ISGPForum.
All right, so now we can really get going with the episode. How about we start everyone off with a bit of a summary? What is the deal with Native North American nutrition, and where exactly is it transitioning to, as Dr. Sampson puts it?
So, although this was news to me, Dr. Sampson explains that it is well documented that Native North Americans suffer from high rates of long-term chronic disease and poor mental health. In these populations, such diseases occur way more frequently than in other populations.
Well, you may have not known that, Dee, because it's actually somewhat of a recent trend. In fact, indigenous peoples in North America used to enjoy excellent health, per historical and anthropological research, as well as testimonials of native peoples themselves.
Okay, so what changed?
Glad you asked. So these health difficulties, both physical and mental, became prevalent when native peoples transitioned away from more self-reliant, land-reliant lives. It's actually when they started to depend on the market and larger food systems that things started to change.
And this trend continues to unfold in many parts of northern Canada and Alaska, where, within living memory, people have been relocated to government-built villages and reservations.
These patterns of ill health have occurred in reservation-bound Native populations from Canada, as well as the United States, and they've occurred from the 19th century onwards.
But what exactly is it about these reservations that caused the moving populations to become chronically ill?
Well, reservation agriculture often failed, making traditional subsistence lifestyles totally impossible. This basically forced reservation inhabitants to become welfare recipients with low incomes.
This designation gave the native populations access to commodity foods in generic packaging with a long shelf life. Now, we're talking about products like orange bricks of cheese, canned beef, chicken, and pork, canned vegetables and fruit, flour, sugar, beans, rice, and like powdered or tinned milk, all products that aren't necessarily the healthiest, especially when they're consumed in combination as the majority of one's diet.
Well, I'm probably really going to regret admitting this, but you know that cheese in a can, the one where you spray it out?
Oh God, oh no.
Ugh. Oh yes, I used to absolutely love that stuff.
Dee, that's so bad. I don't even do that.
Come on, not even on Ritz crackers?
No.
Yeah, no. Not since I was five.
You mustn't have been the healthiest child.
Well, you could say my sister and I relished in our days as chubby children.
Oh, man, I could just picture you guys as the cutest two little chubby twins.
All right, well, regardless, now that Daniela has admitted her love for only the classiest of foods, I think it's time to move on.
Agreed. Okay, so still avidly consumed today, commodity foods are very high in salt and carbohydrates, and on some reservations, they're even referred to as free junk food.
It may come as no surprise, then, that as a result, Native Americans in the U.S. are 420% more likely to die from diabetes than the general population. This is almost entirely caused by bad diets and the lack of exercise.
420%? I didn't even know that that was mathematically possible.
Seriously, that sounds fake. Anyway, diet-related impairments to health begin in childhood, and that's what's happening to these populations. According to Dr. Sampson's research, obesity is now one of the most serious public health problems facing American Indigenous children, hovering at a rate of 25%.
And among Aboriginal populations in Canada, obesity rates in children and adolescents are as high as 52% in select Quebec communities.
We also have to remember that while many chronic illnesses can be traced back to excess fats, sodium, and refined sugars in the diet, thereby triggering obesity, high blood pressure, heart disease, and diabetes, we can't just be thinking about junk food and obesity when discussing nutrition.
As tempting as that may be.
Right. And that's especially because chronic illnesses can also arise from nutritional deficiencies. Some you've probably even heard of before, like iron, iodide, folic acid, vitamin D, and omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids.
And this is exactly why the Native North Americans nutritional transition is such a concern. Moving from traditional foods to commodity foods on the drop of a dime, that must be a huge shock for somebody's body.
And we can talk about Alaska and the Canadian Arctic as an ideal example. Not ideal in the sense that it's a good reality or anything.
Right. Ideal in that it's demonstrative.
Well, subarctic and Arctic populations used to consume marine and land mammals with high omega-3 content, and now they're eating lots of omega-6 fatty acids that come from processed foods, which is very worrying.
This transition to fatty acids raises their cholesterol and triglyceride levels, which can be directly associated with the onset of diabetes and arteriosclerosis.
Hold up on all the big words there.
All right, that's fair. Let's break it down. Triglycerides are a type of fat found in your blood. When you eat, your body converts calories that it doesn't need to use right away into these triglycerides, which are then stored in your fat cells.
And they're associated with the onset of
arteriosclerosis, which basically refers to the thickening of your arteries.
Okay, that's what I was looking for. We can get back to it now.
Oh, I thank you. So considerate of you, Cleo. But anyway, as I was saying, junk foods are made up of fast-release carbohydrates. They basically just dump sugar into the metabolism really quickly. So with high frequency, that'll surely increase one's risk of obesity, colon-related diseases, and of course, diabetes.
And this is specifically risky for Native North Americans. Recent scientific research has shown that Arctic peoples have genetic and physiological adaptations specifically for diets rich in omega fats.
So to put cause and effect together here, we've got an example. The Tohono O'odham people, which I really apologize if I pronounced that wrong, have the highest incidence of diabetes per capita of any group on the planet. However, before their diets changed drastically in the early 20th century, diabetes literally was not a thing to them. Their native foods, including drought-resistant desert beans, cacti, and nuts, all release carbohydrates slowly, protecting them from diabetes.
You know, this really reminds me of episode 38 of our show, where Dr. Sichter explained that Asian Indians are twice as likely to develop type 2 diabetes.
Very true. Super interesting how not only social and economic contexts highlight the importance of personalized nutrition, but genetic differences do too. So don't mind if I plug in a little shout out here, but if you are interested in hearing more about type 2 diabetes and the Asian Indian Challenge, make sure you do check out episode 38.
Thanks for that, Dee. But you do make a good point about social context playing a role. It's important to remember that Dr. Sampson emphasized that it's not just physical health that's affected by this nutrition transition. There's also evidence that dietary changes may be implicated in high rates of poor mental health among Indigenous populations.
That's a really good point, Cleo. Rates of mental health afflictions among these populations are now above national averages.
And while scientists can't claim direct causality, as there are surely other important reasons at play, there's definitely correlation to be noted. Decreased consumption of omega-3 fatty acids has important implications for neuronal and brain development, function, and health, all of which can be associated with increased levels of aggression, depression, postpartum depression, and suicide.
Omega-3s are also essential for mental health function and visual sharpness in babies, at the young end of the age spectrum. Plus, because they're important for the brain, omega-3s could reduce neuron-degenerating disorders, such as Alzheimer's.
Well, it seems pretty odd that what goes on in our stomachs affects what happens in our minds. Dr. Sampson explains that it's actually scientifically unsurprising. It turns out that scientists sometimes call the gut our second brain.
Well, when we think about how other physical activities, such as exercise, have an effect on us mentally, maybe it's not so surprising in general. Physical activity is surely known to be beneficial to both mental and physical health. I mean, I know I'm for sure in a much better mood after going for a run.
Oh, I know. Since I was once your neighbor, there were plenty of times I saw you before and after a run. Definitely preferred you after.
Hey!
I'm just teasing. Although you are one of the happiest people I've probably ever met after your runs, because I'm personally dead.
Yeah, I'm the same way, Cleo. I'm not that person.
Not happy after. No.
No. All right. Well, anyway, now that we know the dangers of the dietary transition that Native North Americans are experiencing, is there anything that we can do? I mean, is there any going back from this?
Well, actually, yeah. This rapid nutritional spiral is not a fait accompli.
Sorry, a what?
Daniela, how many times do we have to tell you to speak English?
Geez, just trying to appeal to our listeners in all 100 plus countries. That is a shout out to all of you out there.
I was going to say nice shout out there.
But in all honesty, Dr. Sampson used the same exact terminology to describe the state of the nutrition transition. You're technically correct, though. It is French, but fait accompli is commonly used in the English language to refer to something that has already happened or been decided before those affected hear about it, leaving them with no option but to just accept it. In French, it literally translates to accomplished fact.
Okay, so we're saying that the transition is actually reversible then?
Well, Professor Michael Pollan at UC Berkeley has reviewed a number of studies indicating that, quote, some of the most toxic effects of the Western diet could be so quickly reversed, at least to some extent, that we can rewind the nutritional transition and undo some of its damage, end quote.
For example, several studies were performed in Australia featuring diabetic Aboriginal populations. They volunteered to only procure and eat hunted, gathered, and fished foods. And when they did so, the whole group showed striking improvements in all the metabolic abnormalities of diabetes.
Similar projects with groups in Canada and Mexico yielded identical results.
This actually reminds me of Dr. Stephen O'Keefe, who was a presenter at another nutrition-related ISGP conference. He explained his absolutely fascinating study. They performed two-week food exchanges in subjects from the same populations. African Americans were fed a high-fiber, low-fat African-style diet, and rural Africans were fed a high-fat, low-fiber Western-style diet, under close supervision, of course. Compared to their usual diets, there were remarkable reciprocal changes in mucosal biomarkers for cancer risk.
Wait, what?
In other words, the high-fat diets made the rural Africans, who were not accustomed to eating such foods, more at risk of cancer in just 2 weeks. And the African Americans, who started eating a healthier rural African diet, showed decreased cancer risk in the same amount of time.
Which, of course, shows that readopting traditional foods might be a way to reverse the upsurge in chronic diseases among indigenous peoples. But it remains true that these populations have less and less opportunity to access and eat traditional foods, not to mention participate in food procurement activities.
But considering the toll already taken on physical and mental health, taking advantage of food procurement opportunities that do exist has become even more difficult. People are straight up demoralized because of high unemployment in villages, chronically overcrowded housing, loss of intergenerational transmission of indigenous knowledge, and lack of physical activity.
So, reversing the nutrition transition seems to require more than a dietary approach, but rather a comprehensive initiative by governments incorporating opportunities and behavioral policy as well.
I mean, yeah, because apart from the cost that is shortened lives and cultural dislocation, there are other costs to governments associated with indigenous populations being so visibly and collectively incapacitated.
So, time for Dee's favorite topic. What exactly can policy do about this?
Well, first of all, kind of as an umbrella here, it is super important to ensure that when considering any policy initiatives at all, in-depth consultations take place with Indigenous representatives.
In that light, Dr. Sampson makes several policy recommendations to address the nutrition transition for Native North Americans. But he, of course, emphasizes that each one of them cannot happen without consulting Indigenous leadership.
All right, so first, Dr. Sampson explains that it's better to incentivize people to improve their lifestyle choices rather than punish them for unhealthy habits. Government funding in many communities is still tied to activities that reinforce unhealthy lifestyles. However, one way in which Northern peoples maintained land-based activities after they were settled in villages was through an outpost program.
And what is that exactly?
An outpost program involves the Canadian government distributing payments to hunting families that need to buy equipment to spend time on the land. Unfortunately, many such programs were discontinued or fell into disarray about 15 years ago.
But as I understand it, it would be far cheaper for the government to reinstate such programs than to actually bear the cost of ill health associated with sedentary living.
Yeah, but there are also opportunities here for public-private partnerships to redirect funding and help renew an outpost program.
Alternatively, Dr. Sampson suggested that the government could support grassroots initiatives from communities engaged in land-based cultural revitalization projects. These are often fragmented and could benefit tremendously from comprehensive government support.
To give an example here, a successful model along these lines has been the Hunters Support Program operating in Quebec, which releases funds to Aboriginal organizations that pay Inuit and Cree hunters for the meat and fish that they bring home.
This program provides the hunters with a traditional diet and a small income for the time spent hunting, and it also helps to subsidize the purchase of hunting equipment and transportation. This model has positive externalities for others in the surrounding villages too, because after the hunters take some of the food for themselves, they then distribute free food throughout the villages.
Subsistent food consumption then replaces expensive, less healthy imported foods. At the same time, such a policy helps to promote the economic viability of indigenous communities. Actually, a similar program has been operational under Home Rule in parts of Greenland.
But in order to support the transition back to subsistence living and traditional foods, younger generations need certain skills to have such a lifestyle and keep it going into the future. And with that in mind, education is seriously key.
This means supporting experiential education, enabling young people to learn indigenous knowledge and ecological literacy, probably through training in outdoor skills, animal behavior, habitat conservation, and topography.
In fact, in 1999, Dr. Sampson conducted a study on an Innu experiential learning project in Labrador. He found virtually unanimous support from all adults among the 60 people interviewed. However, no changes were implemented after his report was published. He argues that this was largely a result of indifference from the mainstream school board being preoccupied with more immediate concerns.
And so that's clearly an obstacle, but others exist, of course. Another obstacle in implementing such an initiative is, ironically, the poor health of many Indigenous populations, which impairs outdoor activity. This is the definition of a vicious cycle.
And beyond overcoming these health difficulties, such an educational program would seek to address in the first place, implementation of experiential learning is also hindered by the academic calendar running on the European agricultural cycle.
While these obstacles are surmountable, they do require systematic coordination of health, educational, and political authorities. Dr. Sampson suggested that such coordination could be encouraged by student exchanges, basically enabling non-Aboriginal students to learn Indigenous knowledge. You could kind of consider it an aspect of general scientific knowledge.
These programs could target educational charities as well as independent and state schools.
One of the key points urged at the debate was that it's important to reconsider the prioritized economic base.
All right, negative Nancy.
No, I didn't mean that these proposed educational exchanges and proposed policies won't work. I'm actually referring to Dr. Sampson's reframing of the current economic situation. He explains that despite recent native involvement in lucrative but short-term extractive industries, there's no evidence that ever-increasing material consumption generates improvements in well-being beyond a low base of per capita GDP.
That was so many economics words, but what I think this boils down to is he even explains that when increased standards of living come at the cost of cultural meaning and purpose, it basically just doesn't make people happier, and it does not improve well-being.
Instead, Dr. Sampson proposes that a greener indigenous economy could create programs to help people earn an income and return to vibrant health. This would decrease any dependence on any money made from extractive industries on tribal lands, which would be freaking sweet. Therefore, as mentioned earlier, ecotourism and land-based education could be introduced.
As always, this would require an interdisciplinary approach involving government agencies, businesses, banks, and marketing agencies.
All right, well, that kind of seems like a perfect way to end, you know, on a forum favorite topic called interdisciplinarity. Should we summarize and wrap up?
Sounds good to me. All right, so what did we talk about today?
Well, if you don't remember, it sounds to me like you need to consume a bit more of omega-3s.
Come on, Daniela. So today we spoke about the fact that the nutritional transition is one of the most important issues affecting the health of Indigenous peoples worldwide.
It entails a change from gathered, farmed, fished, and hunted foods to industrialized, energy-dense diets. This has been accompanied by population shifts from physically active to sedentary lifestyles.
Traditional Indigenous foods, combined with the exercise required to procure them, are strongly associated with good physical and mental health. Therefore, the introduction of policies to encourage land-based activities provides a means to reverse the negative effects of the nutritional transition.
Severe diet-related health problems can be tackled through more robust support for land-based activities and programs in experiential education, as well as educational exchanges and revenue-generating enterprises based on Indigenous ecological literacy and knowledge.
And while governments, schools, charities, and businesses need to effect positive changes, we need to keep in mind that Indigenous groups themselves must be the main partners.
So now it's time for you to weigh in.
Do you think it's realistically feasible to reverse the changes in dietary patterns that have taken place among the Native North American populations?
Do you think supporting a land-based hunting model is the best option? How about some of the educational programs we detailed today? If you had all the control and got to choose, which policies would you implement first?
Make sure to share your thoughts with us on Twitter at ISGP Forum or on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGP Forum.
As always, thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to chatting with you next time, right here on the forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.